Welcome to WISO Weekend, WISO's weekly radio magazine. I'm Jerry Kenny. On today's program, we've got this week's reinvention story, and Community Voices producer Jocelyn Robinson is back with a memorable edition of Rediscovered Radio. This morning, WISO brings you a new WISO Weekend feature, Call and Response with Dr. Daryl Ward. That's coming up later in the program. Up first, the National Weather Service did determine that the tornado that touched down in Cedarville Wednesday evening was classified as an EF3. Several homes and buildings were destroyed by the intense storm that hit the village around 6 p.m. WISO's Wayne Baker reports.
Forecaster John Franks with the National Weather Service out of Wilmington said Wednesday's storm was narrow but contained deadly winds.
The estimated maximum wind speed of that storm was 145 miles an hour, and the EF3 category runs from 136 to 165 miles an hour.
Most of the damage in Cedarville was on Barber and Weimer roads. Roger Dobbins and family were at home when the tornado hit and it destroyed their house. Another home in Cedarville was also demolished, but nobody was at home at the time. Only minor injuries were reported after seven members of the Dobbins family were rescued by EMS personnel. Wayne Baker, WYSO.
Today on Reinvention Stories, we meet Jan Underwood from Dayton's Santa Clara neighborhood. It's between Salem Avenue and North Main Street, just north of downtown. Underwood was a photographer at the Dayton Daily News for many years until changes in newspaper publishing and in her personal life forced her to reinvent herself.
My first camera I got on a bad loan. I had loaned somebody money. It was my sweetheart. And he couldn't pay me back, so he gave me his camera. I went to the Dayton Art Institute to learn photography. I became a photographer at the Dayton Daily News after I graduated from Ohio State. When I fell in love with newspapers, we didn't consider it a business. You know, we were journalists, and we were above the business fray. We were doing really good, and Dayton was doing great. Santa Clara was just across the road from us. Art galleries opening up there, Omega Records. You know, people were out walking with their children and strollers, and it was just a very working class but comfortable neighborhood to be in. And it was just such a great time for a little while there. About 2005, 2006, the internet started competing with newspapers, and our profit margins started plummeting. I was one of the older staffers, not as quick to learn technology, and so there was a lot of stress at that point. They told us that they were not going to do the layoffs according to seniority. They were going to use this special skills clause to select who had special skills. I was at home. It was my day off, and I was out in the backyard working when I got the phone call telling me that I was on the list. The union fought for us and turned it into a buyout instead of a layoff. Then things started happening in the neighborhood. In 2010, somebody broke in and ransacked the house, took everything of value. And then in 2011, we were gone for an hour and came home, and somebody was in our house. My son walked in ahead of me and got punched and shoved by a burglar. So my son, who is 15 years old, is afraid to be home at night by himself. At the same time, my mom, who was 84, I think, at that point, needed to have hip replacement surgery and needed 24-hour care. She lived alone. She lives in the house where I grew up. Sort of the confluence of factors. My son and I moved in with my mother. I had a life transplant, a total life transplant, because it was just such a major change. In every way. I drew unemployment, which of course requires that you apply for at least two jobs a week. Well, there were weeks when I couldn't find two jobs to apply for. The presence of digital cameras and digital phones and digital everything, nobody feels like they need a professional photographer anymore. Right. Even the Dayton Daily News and Channel 7, they just solicit free photographs from amateurs. Chicago Sun-Times laid off all of their photographers. People like seeing their pictures in the paper or online or whatever, you know, so they don't need to pay for it. Started getting a little bit of freelance work here and a little bit of freelance work there, and then it got really busy in the fall, and it was good work. I had a very good fall, busy but very good. Losing my job was definitely a good thing in that I was able to be there for my mom when she needed me. I was able to pick up and move when we needed to move. I'm glad I'm not still working at the newspaper because it's not the job that I fell in love with. It's not the industry or the business that I fell in love with. I thought that I wouldn't continue to work as a photographer, but there's no way that I cannot. It is just like a part of me. It's my baby. It's my best friend. It's such an extension of who I am that I may not get paid for it, but I will continue to take pictures.
Julia Reichert produced this story. Her film about Jan Underwood's reinvention is on our website at WYSO.org. Major funding for the second season of Reinvention Stories comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, with support from Wright State University's Celia Fund, the Yellow Springs Community Foundation, and Antioch College. I'm Jerry Kenney. You're listening to WYSO Weekend on 91.3 WYSO. Thanks for joining us this Sunday morning. Coming up later in the program, Call and Response with Dr. Daryl Ward, a new feature on WYSO Weekend. Up next, in the spring of 1970, college campuses across the nation erupted in protests, mainly against the escalation of the war in Vietnam. We remember May 4th, the day Ohio National Guardsmen opened fire on demonstrators at Kent State University, killing 4 students and wounding 9. Only 10 days later, another campus shooting left 2 dead and a dozen injured at a historically black college in Mississippi, but that event is not part of our collective consciousness. Rediscovered Radio's Jocelyn Robinson found archival tape of interviews recorded within hours of the tragedy that took place 44 years ago this past week.
We remember May 4th, 1970. We remember that image of an anguished Marianne Vecchio kneeling next to the body of murdered Kent State student Jeffrey Miller. We remember, too, the grim lyrics of Ohio by Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young. Do we remember, though, what happened on May 15th, 1970, at Jackson State College in Mississippi?
No, I do not.
I unfortunately do not.
I can't remember it right now. I'm sorry.
That was Tiffany Richards, Malik Perkins, and Charles McNeil, mass communication students at Central State University. Accounts vary on why law enforcement was called to Jackson State that day. Students were agitated. Over several days, there had been reports of rocks thrown at white motorists on Lynch Street, a main thoroughfare running through campus. Even more significant than demonstrations against the war, racial tensions in Jackson were escalating. Just after midnight, city police and state troopers used deadly force against unarmed students gathered outside a women's dorm. A half-minute barrage shattered windows and blasted concrete walls. Philip Lafayette Gibbs, a 21-year-old junior, and James Earl Green, 17, a high school senior walking home from his job at a nearby grocery store, were killed. There is no iconic photograph, no folk rock anthem to remind us of what happened at Jackson State College. In the WYSO archives, though, there's an 18-minute documentary with phone interviews recorded with witnesses just hours after the shooting. There's no narration. The speakers, including several obviously shaken Antioch students, aren't identified. We don't know who produced it or when it aired, and some of the audio is difficult to understand. Even still, the tape is chilling.
But about 8:30 or 9 o'clock, they start moving all these guys in here, the National Guard, these armored personnel carriers, and the highway patrol and so forth. They got them out there as if they were going to talk to them. And like one cop faced the students and said something like, "Ladies and gentlemen, can I have your attention?" And the students turn around to face the cops, and as soon as they turn around, they open fire.
There was blood all on the first floor. And the bullets they used were so big that they penetrated through the brick wall and through the steel. inside the dormitory and then went through the door, so evidently they were shooting to kill. And so on all five floors, there were bullets. You know, every last floor, there were bullets.
Dr. Kevin Magruder, professor of history at Antioch College, listened to the documentary.
It's very clear to the people who were there that it just made no sense, the whole thing. And in the context of Kent State, which also made no sense, the level of violence is just almost unbelievable if there weren't these accounts of it, particularly to bring those kinds of firearms to a college campus. It really sounded like the authorities were trying to spark something. And that's not necessarily surprising, but it's disturbing. I mean, when you really get to the core of it, it's even something different than violence. It's how life is valued, that black life is not valued in the same way as white life. So if black life was valued in the same way as white life, it would have been unthinkable to bring out the heavy artillery to deal with students.
A month after the shootings, President Richard Nixon appointed a commission to investigate campus unrest and the heavy-handed responses to it. That fall, the resulting report concluded that the Kent State shootings were unnecessary, unwarranted, and inexcusable. In the case of Jackson State, the extreme firepower used was found unjustified. But no one was convicted in the Mississippi murders. For Rediscovered Radio at WYSO, I'm Jocelyn Robinson.
Major support for Rediscovered Radio comes from the Ohio Humanities Council and the Greene County Public Library.
People moving out, people moving in. Why? Because of the color of the skin.
Run, run, run,
but you sure can't hide. And I, boy, and I, a tooth for a tooth. Vote for me and I'll set you free. Teacher, segregation, determination, demonstration, integration, aggravation, humiliation, obligation to our nation. That's what the world is today.
I'm Jerry Kenny. This is WYSO Weekend on 91.3 WYSO, public radio for the Miami Valley. Coming up next, a new feature, Call and Response, where we spotlight ideas and conversation from our region's African American and Hispanic populations. Here is the premiere broadcast with our host, Dr. Daryl Ward.
This is Call and Response, celebrating the diversity of the Miami Valley. I'm Daryl Ward. I talk for a living in the black church and in the community. Today, we're observing the 89th birthday of slain civil rights leader Malcolm X. Joining us is Larry Crow, an oral historian and producer for the History Makers Online Project. May 19th is Malcolm X's birthday. Why are we still so interested in the life of Malcolm X nearly 50 years after he was assassinated?
Well, Malcolm X, along with to some extent like Marcus Garvey and Paul Robeson, was an international figure and a spokesman for black people's rights and our position in terms of confronting power in the world. Because everywhere you go in the world, black people, especially in his days, were subjugated in colonialism or, you know, under segregation in the United States and discrimination. You know, and it was the same in Africa and other places, even though they didn't have a majority white population dictating to them. They were still fighting a worldwide, you know, concept of white supremacy. And Malcolm spoke to that, you know, not only on the street corners of Harlem, in the mosque when he was in the Nation of Islam, but also, you know, in those countries. And, you know, he had relationships with heads of state, the emerging heads of state of the third world in Africa, the Middle East, and in Asia.
I want to ask for our listeners who may say, well, you know, that's old, and we need to, in 2014, we've got other issues, and we're in a global society, and African-American history or things done wrong to African-Americans, that's way in the past. And
the people who would argue in favor of that are not facing reality. I mean, things have not changed that much. They've changed some, and we owe the civil rights movement. We owe the cultural nationalist movement. We owe people that struggled ahead of us for the positive changes and the freedoms that we have, but it's not over yet. We're not in post-racial America yet.
He didn't have the credentials. He didn't work for some big international organization. How did he blow up?
Well, people when they heard Malcolm X, and you know, I was like 15 when Malcolm was assassinated, and there wasn't a lot of Malcolm X in the media in those days. And I subsequently, you know, started, you know, listening to the records, you know, his last message and the material that was recorded in Detroit and New York and other places where he spoke, Chicago. But he resonates with people. When you hear him speak and address an issue, and he says, like, well, this is because you hate yourself. Look at yourself. And who taught you to hate yourself? The same blue-eyed white man. And, you know, well, everybody knows that's true. You know it's true. But people don't really. You might hear it on a corner or in a barbershop, but nobody gets up and says that.
We are never taught about any black hero. Only someone we're shown in history is my grandfather was picking cotton. Cotton picking don't move me. No. But when it comes to teaching the black people something about great black men who stood their ground, who were scientists, who were civilizers, who were fathers of culture and civilization, the white man has shrewdly written that role out of the textbook.
He actually would say that. He said, well, what sense does it make to be nonviolent? You know, if you're not going to be nonviolent with me, why should I be nonviolent with you? I mean, nonviolence was a strategy, of course, and I think he understood that. But the concept, and it didn't work everywhere.
Right.
It didn't work in the streets of New York City. And some of the issues that they had there, like it worked in Selma, Alabama. So
there are those who love Dr. King and are afraid of Malcolm X. Why is that?
Well, first of all, we have a false notion of Dr. King that was, I think, perpetrated by his family because they were tired of being in trouble all the time because they tried to assassinate Martin Luther King all the time. His family was in constant danger. They had to have guards around the house and move secretly. And I think Coretta Scott King was trying to avoid that when they created the Martin Luther King Center for Nonviolent Social Change. But Malcolm X, likewise, caused people to really look at – I know in 63 when I was 13, after JFK was assassinated, he said it was a case of the chickens coming home to roost, meaning that the U.S. has, you know, sponsored and carried out the assassination of world leaders all over the globe. And – you know, and it's now we actually know that. I mean, in those days, he was, you know, some could say that was speculation. Now, in retrospect, you have the FBI files, you have records you can go back and look and then see where the role they played in the assassination of Patrice Lumumba and other people. He was right. He said, and, you know, it's not that he wanted to see Kennedy assassinated, but the U.S. government have, you know, there are things the Obama administration is doing now that if we really thought about them are not dissimilar to what George Bush was doing. It's because being president does not allow you to have total control over what's going on. It's, as Eisenhower said, a military-industrial complex is complicated. Mm-hmm. So Malcolm tried to clear up some of those complications for us, to try to draw the lines, to try to, you know, delineate what was actually going on.
Why should we celebrate? Why should we? Because there are listeners listening now who are saying to themselves, well, he was a crook. He was a villain.
The reason why we should focus on Malcolm is because he, as you said, he tried to make things plain. He loved his people unconditionally, and we were his project. He was the only public speaker in those days who really made that clear. He said, I don't have anything against anybody else. He says, yeah. I want peace throughout the world. He says, but my aim— right. is black nationalism. I want to see black people, you know, step up and take their place in decision making, in the economic life of the world, and, you know, and the cultural life of the world, to make the mark that we can make. And that's what he was striving for.
Malcolm was clear, and that's one of the things that I love about his voice. It resonates with so many of us. But, you know, everybody who's written about him has not been celebrated. Dr. Manning Marable, who is a native of Dayton, wrote a book about him that I understand has been very controversial.
Yeah, it's been kind of controversial. I mean, he received praise from a lot of the higher echelon academics in the black community, like Skip Gates and others. They said it was a great book. I don't know if they read it or had, but it's, I mean, it's got good content. It has some good content, but it's he spends too much time, I think, on innuendo and unsupported data. Like he says, he infers that Malcolm may have been gay, you know. Well, if he was, nobody really knows it, and his references don't really substantiate it. Somebody's cousin, Shorty's cousin, told Bruce Perry, who is the author of a Malcolm X book, a white man, told him that story that Bruce Perry repeated, then Zach Kondo repeated to his, and he's sorry he repeated it now, Zach Kondo is, and he's in his book, he says, I wish I had never said that because it's unsubstantiated, it's just some talk.
So there's innuendo, there's some unsupported assertions, that kind of thing. I think that what all of the listeners should take away is that intellect is non-racial. You know, Malcolm X was this wonderful brain that was here, that spoke to issues that really mattered for black people. Black people were his agenda. You know, that this is what I do. This is my bag. This is what I carry. But if you really value truth, you listen. And I think one of the things that people can do as we celebrate his birthday is listen. Because he, when you really listen to Malcolm X, he's not trying to beat you down or hate you or hate your mama or anything like that. He's just speaking truth. And he does it so well. You know, I love the fact that Malcolm was a brother who, you know, he spouted certain rhetoric and then he went to the Holy Land and he saw that it was different.
Dr. James Turner of Cornell used to talk about this all the time. We'd bring him to Chicago every year. He'd speak at the University of Chicago. But he would always say that when Malcolm's spiritual experience, as explained by Malcolm X, it was better to have Malcolm explain it, and he did explain it. He said, I had a spiritual experience over there. He said, and I saw people who were righteous. They were all colors.
Yeah.
He said, but when I'm back in the United States, and I know who the enemy of black people is in the United States. It's the enemy is white supremacy. It's not all white people, every individual white person, but the institutional white supremacy is our enemy. Any institution that puts white ahead of any color, you know, any other people, and their rights and privileges above everyone else, and they walk over everybody else, it's wrong, you know. So it has to be, we have to fight against that, and we have to, hold up that which holds us up in front of our people. That's what we have to do.
The majority of our listeners are probably white. How should they respond to Malcolm X?
I don't spend a lot of time trying to sort that out for them. But there are white people, heroic white people, that talk to white people about these issues. And they're here in Yellow Springs and in Dayton, too. But I think that what we should come away with this discussion with is that, you know, we're at the 50th anniversary of the assassination of Malcolm X, which was something that was a collusion between government and Nation of Islam. Mm-hmm. I mean, it wouldn't have happened unless Nation of Islam was a part of it, you know, and they pulled the trigger, actually, you know. But when we think about the life of Malcolm X, we think about someone who represented, you know, some of our highest ideals. And when you listen to him talk, you listen to his discourses on the streets and in the he was everywhere. He spoke at Harvard, spoke in London, everywhere, you know. People brought him to speak because he made sense.
Yep.
You know, he made sense. He simply made sense. So that's what we should take away from this, and that we should read the things he would say were informed by education. He read. He said he could spend the rest of his life in a library, and his curiosity would take the rest. I mean, he was that curious.
I don't advocate any kind of hate. I don't believe in any form of segregation or any form of racism, but I don't believe
enforcing my desire for brotherhood upon those who aren't willing to accept it.
Of course, I think the Christians would say that they also believed in brotherhood. What did you say to that?
I'd say they believe in it, but don't practice it.
Are there other movements that resonate with you that you'd look and you see, yeah, they're doing the right stuff?
Yeah, I left Chicago in 1977 to join an organization called the Institute for Positive Education in Chicago, where the director and the organization was advocating becoming a vegetarian, was advocating for the environment, was advocating that we read, that we teach our children in new ways that would create thinkers rather than just people that could fill out a test. We would exercise every morning, you know, before we'd start work. And there are people and groups all around the country, and African Americans too, that focus on a bigger picture than just, you know, than just the rights. We're trying to improve life in general, you know, specifically for us. You know, as you look at the world, we have like the highest rates of diabetes and lung cancer. We're still smoking. You know, we're doing things. I mean, black folks, poor people really around the world are the last ones to stop doing self-destructive things. They just don't know. It's an educational issue. I mean, I think when you do things and you're sincere, as Malcolm used to say, he says sincerity is his number one quality. Yeah. He said, even if you disagree with me, if you're sincere, I can respect you.
That's good.
But sincerity, means a lot.
That's good. That's good. That's amen. I believe you. What would you say in summary?
If you haven't read the works of Malcolm X, born in 1925, died in 1665, if you haven't read the works, read them. You know, listen to his speeches on YouTube. They make sense. I mean, his early speeches, he's in the rhetoric of the Nation of Islam. He's calling white people devils and that sort of thing and talking about Yaqub every now and then. But there's a certain point he gets kind of bemused about that and gets past it. And he talks about international politics in a way that nobody has, people have rarely done since. And it's so important. His bond with African people is really important, too. That's something that Spike Lee omitted from the movie for some reason, his trip to Africa, where he actually goes to Ghana and other African nations and meets with African heads of state. I think that's what sort of threatened the government on some level. But, of course, you don't have to do a lot to threaten the U.S. government in terms of – I mean, in those days with J. Edgar Hoover in charge, I didn't take a lot. But who have that kind of a stage? So, yeah. Learn about Malcolm X and try to be – whatever you do, try to be sincere.
Amen. Thank you. Thank you so much, Brother Crow.
Yes, sir.
Appreciate your wisdom.
Thank you.
Thank you for sharing with us on WYSO. That was an interview with Larry Crow, an oral historian with the HistoryMakers.com project. Larry is a graduate in history from Wright State University. The executive producer for Call and Response is Dana Perkins. Today's program was produced by Basim Blunt. I'm Daryl Ward.
Call and Response is a new feature on WISO Weekend. If you'd like to call and respond with your comments and feedback, our phone number, 937-769-1374, or email us at wyso@wyso.org. That's it for this edition of WISO Weekend on 91.3 WYSO, Yellow Springs, Dayton, Springfield, and online at wyso.org. WYSO is a community service of Antioch College for the Miami Valley and beyond. Up next on WISO, the Book Nook.
This week on American Roots, John Sebastian talks about growing up in Greenwich Village, hanging out with blues great Mississippi John Hurt, and starting the Lovin' Spoonful. Then conversation with Christy Guillory and Christian Bolfa of Bonsoir Catan about carrying Cajun music into a new century. I'm Nick Spitzer. Join me for American Roots from PRX.
Tune into American Roots this afternoon at 2 on 91.3 WYSO.
Uno, dos, tres, four.
Thank you.